So this is going to be about thinking and how do we practice when thinking emerges. And it's interesting when one looks into any area of the Dharma. It's funny, Bhavani appeared and disappeared. That you start to pull out, recognize places where teachers have touched on that aspect. You know, sort of the figure ground shifts. It's really interesting. And I picked up on two quotes that I thought were really appropriate about the question of thinking. There she is. Because this is a significant area to work with, because mindfulness practice is about recognizing the nature of things. It's about clear seeing. And a lot of what happens for most of us in our practice is thinking emerges. I mean, we're mindful of our body, but thinking pops up and comes and goes and comes and goes. Anyone have that experience? I'm just kind of guessing. Yes? No? Okay. So, yeah, right. Look at you. They call it monkey mind sometimes, right? So it's a big deal. And how do you do that? And one of the tricky bits that we see is that we tend to think that our thinking is us. In the same way, even subtler, we tend to think our consciousness is us, but we'll just stick with thinking now. You know, and the stuff we're thinking about, that's who we think we are. So we get kind of attached to it and involved in it and lost in it and all of that. So to be able to be mindful of it is actually a bigger deal than it might seem. It's actually quite powerful. Now, speaking of quotes, 17th century philosopher René Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am." And that's sort of, well, would not be a Buddhist quote because it's just the opposite. But that's helpful to see from his point of view. He's talking about how it is for most people. You know, I think, therefore I am, because that's who I am. From a Dharma point of view, we see through that. You know, we realize that's actually not who we are. There's no there. There's no self there. There's just thinking happening. But the way he saw it can clarify the way we tend to mistakenly think it is. For most of us, it'd be like, I think, therefore I'm convinced I am, is maybe how we are. But we want to unwind that in our practice. And it shows up in the lists, you know, the great lists that are so significant in the Dharma, especially in the five skandhas or the five aggregates, also called the five khandhas, that make up our sense of self. And it's body, vedana, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. And mental formations is this whole arena of thinking about and planning, and all this mental activity is one of the emergings that we tend to build a self out of. And it also shows up in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, where the skandhas show up again. But then the message there is, all those five, be mindful of them. That's what you got to do when these emerge. So there are two places where he doesn't talk about it a whole lot in a certain direct way, but this is how it shows up to be mindful of. And what people often think is that thinking is a problem or an enemy of their meditation. They think, oh, you know, I'm going to meditate and everything will be all quiet and everything will calm down. And for some people it does. I know some people that have astonishing powers of one-pointedness and can do what's called the jhanas. A gentleman named Jason Bartlett, who teaches around here, is a friend of mine. He's unbelievable in that area. And there's one quiet person who comes here once in a while. She doesn't talk about it much, but she is like that. So some people can do that, and some people have temperament or karma or something that makes it easy, and that's just how it is. But that's not the whole ball of wax. It's just they have a skill in that area. But for most of us, got a monkey mind, and many people tend to think this is a real problem, and they dislike it, and they think they're failing, and they struggle, and they have self, you know, debates with themselves about it. So that's too bad, because it's not that. It's just what's arising. And, you know, I always struggle with this myself, because on the one hand, like in a long retreat, for instance, sometimes for some people, things really settle down and can get extraordinarily quiet. And there's a kind of mindfulness, insight happens in a powerful way there. That's part of why one does a long retreat. But that's not necessarily what happens, because sometimes it goes in waves. And there'll be a quiet period and then a really loud period and a quiet period and a loud period, because there's also this unleaving, unpacking, the onion skin peeling, the traumas being seen, you know, as part of the journey. So, you know, at this point, whatever's unfolding for any one person is perfect. That's how it is for them. That's who they are in their many, many lifetimes. And it's perfect. So I worry about it less and less. And that's part of what I want to offer here is don't worry about it. But how do you work with it? How do you work with it? And, you know, we have brains, and brains process stuff. And that's part of our evolution. I'm editing this book right now, a Dharma book it's pretty amazing. It's by this incredibly brilliant, he's a pathologist at Johns Hopkins, who's writing a book about science and the Dharma. And he has some very interesting stuff about evolution and how that's brought us to how our minds work. And it's kind of impressive. You know, actually, you can see how this thinking thing that our brains do, that's part of how we learn to socialize. That's part of why, for better or for worse, we're the dominant life form. But it is, so we can kind of just, you know, understand that and then learn how to be mindful of it, is what brains do. So I have a couple quotes here that I really jumped out at me. One by Utejaniya. He's a Burmese master, Utejaniya, and he says, "Don't be disturbed by the thinking mind. You are not practicing to prevent thinking, but to recognize thinking when it arises. What is the mind doing? Thinking or being aware?" I think that's really cool. Like, what is the mind doing? Is it thinking, or are you being aware of thinking, or being aware of dog barking, or being aware of knee hurting, or whatever it is? It's all the same thing. But are you being aware, as opposed to thinking lost in it, which is so easy to do? I mean, it's the most beguiling. Dogs barking, other than being irritated, unless you love the dog, it has not so beguiling, or even knee hurting. You know, at a certain point, you can kind of, okay, fine, thinking will just take you away. So it's a real subtle area to keep cultivating mindfulness of. And, you know, when it calms down, great. But if it doesn't calm down, that's okay too. But to be mindful of it, to keep cultivating it and the, kind of welcome it as an area to exercise. And part of how it's sticky is that we conventionally think that there is an I who is doing the thinking. We think I am thinking. And that's part of how we get stuck there, because we sort of posit an I. If there's thinking happening, there must be an I doing it. And we build our I out of that. And that's the tricky subtle bit. And that's part of what makes it so kind of adhering. Because if you look at how, sort of take a look at the kinds of things we think about, and we're generally always thinking about ourselves in relationship to whatever. It's always like our telling ourselves the story of ourselves all the time. And we're planning and we're regretting and we're doing all this stuff, but it's always very I-centered, mostly the kind of stuff that sucks us off in meditation. You know, we may, you know, maybe once in a while we're thinking about the problems of the world, but 97% of it is thinking about us. And it gets concretized just because we keep reinforcing the I-ness. But what if we had a whole different relationship with it and we weren't so sticky about I? Then it's held in a different way. There's a famous book. I've mentioned this before because I just love this title, which I honestly have never even read the book. I just love the title, Thoughts Without a Thinker by Mark Epstein. Put it that understanding that thoughts are happening without a thinker thinking them is part of how we cut through in practice. And you know, it's kind of embarrassing when you really start to watch what's happening, that like of all the stuff that comes and goes and comes and goes, you sort of don't have any control over it. It's just happening. Like if you were doing the thinking, you'd think you could control what comes up and goes away, but mostly it doesn't. You know, if you sit for 30 minutes and it's like just this bizarre cavalcade of things, which to some degree may come out of our traumas, but all kinds of characteristics of us. Otherwise, we could just choose. In the Dalai, the Buddha, in the second sermon, there's three sermons that are chronologically denoted. And two of them, he gave in Sarnath, and the third one on a hill in Gaya, outside of Bodh Gaya in India. And Sarnath is outside of Varanasi. So he walked, the story goes, it's so beautiful. He awakened in Bodh Gaya, and then he, in his mind's eye, saw that his disciples were in Sarnath, which is about 150 miles away. And he walked there over a course of days and gave the first teachings to these five ascetics that he'd been friends with when they were basically starving themselves in India as ascetics for many years. So it's just, I always kind of, it's just beautiful. I've been to Sarnath twice, and it's just this amazing place where the first turning of the wheel was. But anyway, in the second one, the second sermon, and it's not talking about thinking, but to get the quote, it's about consciousness. So the last skanda, he says, bhikkhus, consciousness is not self. Were consciousness self, then this consciousness would not lead to affliction, and one could have it of consciousness, let my consciousness be thus, let my consciousness be that not thus. And since consciousness is not self, so it leads to affliction, and none can have it of consciousness, let my consciousness be thus, let my consciousness be not thus. And to decode that a little bit, he does that for all five of the skandhas. So body, you know, if ourselves were body, then we should be able to just tell it what to do. Be healthy, be handsome, be whatever we want, you know. It would be, we could do it, supposedly. Or if our thinking was us, we could just absolutely control our thinking. But he's saying, well, you know, you can't control any of those things. You can maybe, you know, influence them a little bit, but they all are happening kind of on their own. So it's not us. It's not yourself. And part of what happens in practice is, it's like we don't, when people first start practicing, they're often shocked about how much stuff is going on in their minds. And they don't realize that's what they were doing anyway. They just calmed down enough and listened enough and paid attention enough to see the constant buzz that was there in the first place. So it's not like we're making things worse. We're just starting to see in that, even though that can be a little overwhelming, that is in fact the step toward letting go or seeing through. And so that very sort of dump that happens when you first start practicing of all kinds of stuff, it's seeing clearly. It's really beautiful. And that is, you start to see how incessant our minds are much of the time. So it's how we work with this. That's the trick. And to be mindful of the process of thinking, that's sort of the shift that you need to make. It's not the content of the thinking, but the process of the thinking. Then it moves it away from caring what particularly is emerging. Gough Ronsdale has this great term, which I think is whatever he calls it, thoughting. Not thinking, but thoughting. And it's really useful. And you can use that in noting practice. Noting practice is when you sort of name something that's happening. Like if your knee was hurting, you could just in a little small voice in your mind while you're practicing, just say pain, 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 and just helps you become aware of this thing hitting you in your awareness without being lost in it. You could just name it, and it helps you see it without being lost in it. Same with thinking. You know, if there's like a lot of thinking going on, just to be able to name it keeps us from being caught into all the kind of the papancha, that when one thing leads to another thing, to another thing, to another thing, all that. But he proposes using the word thoughting, and I found, you might try it out, I found it really helpful myself, because thinking kind of posits in our subconscious someone who is thinking. It almost feels like I am thinking, you know, it's built in to the verb. But thoughting, it's not like that. It's just, like it's sort of happening. There's no, it's not, but we're not led to impute an I. So it can be a very helpful way to do noting and just see, help you see that it's just this impersonal phenomena happening. And then we can be more mindful of it. And, you know, from my experience, and this is to be sure, it's an area, it's kind of one of my edges is the whole world of thinking, because I have a very busy mind and I'm involved in so much stuff. I got all kinds of things that are flying around that I'm working on. So when I sit down, it wants to come up. And so just kind of being okay with that. And, you know, this is not a talk about shamatha or steady attention. But to just keep working that edge, you know, to be mindful of thinking when it's happening and cultivate steady attention as you can. And they both have a role. And the more we can be steadily, you know, steadily mindful of busy mind, the steadiness of awareness of busy mind. There's the steadiness part is not, it doesn't stop the mind from being busy necessarily, might, but maybe not, but to be steadily aware of busy mind. That's actually significant. That is a aspect of concentration. So to kind of dance in all that stuff is really, really useful. And, you know, I was, who was this? I'm trying to think. It might have been Jayasaro. It was, who's coming here, by the way, but it was a monastic who spent decades in Asia and just saying in terms of like, you know, Thai village life, it's so much simpler, historically anyway, so much simpler is that a lot of Thai lay people even can just click down in the concentration pretty easy. And it's harder for us in the 21st century in the middle of the madness to do that. And that's okay. But just to be aware of that and kind to us and don't get upset about it and keep looking for the edge of mindfulness, because that really is where insight comes from anyway, whatever it is. You know, I know several people. I remember Rodney Smith had a dog. Speaking of, like you mentioned, dogs, but he had a dog barking incessantly and right next to his house. Rodney Smith was the founder of Sims. It was actually really hard for him. He's a very accomplished meditator, you know, a very significant national teacher, and his dog was barking in his ear all the time. And he really, really didn't like it, and he was really trying to work with it. And it's just like, it's kind of like thinking, you know, this lab thing, and what do you do? So it's. So just always remember, almost remind yourself, the goal is being mindful. The goal is not stopping thinking, because that you probably won't succeed unless you do, unless it happens. You know, it sort of happens, but you won't stop it. It may happen, but you won't stop it. But mindful, you can work on that. So keep reminding yourself of that. That's where insight comes from. And that is also part of the power of this practice, because then insofar as however long we sit in the cushion, whatever we do, 30 minutes, an hour in the morning or something, then there's the rest of our life. And this has to work in the rest of our life. You know, it has to work when someone we love is like completely on our case or something, or when our boss is being really, really difficult, or when we're on a ridiculous deadline that is way too much, or whatever it is, has to work then. And so really embracing the fact that thinking and stuff arises when sitting, it helps us be present then. It's not like a different world, or it's not like, oh, I can't do this. Well, actually we can. You know, it's not like I can't be mindful here because we were just training on that in the cushion when we were obsessed by something. So I find it really helpful in terms of how we navigate the life and bring mindfulness into the world. It's not like, you know, when we're sitting, that's the private special quiet place. And then there's a hard place out there. It's like, nope, it can be pretty hard here too. But then we get strength. And that's part of that's part of the compassion that arises out of the practice, is to be able to be mindful and show up even when someone else is being impossible. They're not mindful. They're just dumping stuff on you or something. To be able to show up with what's going on inside of us, with what's going on inside of them, to be mindful of that. And we just, by the way, we're training on that. 2 days ago, when our head was full of thoughts on the cushion. So I think it's really helpful that way. Yeah, and that's, you know, that's what suffering is. That first noble truth is that life is unsatisfactory when we're not aware, basically. When we're not aware and free, life is unsatisfactory because things aren't always going to work out the way we want. And oh, by the way, we're going to get old and we're going to get sick and we're going to die no matter how wealthy we are. It doesn't matter, right? So it's inherently not satisfactory if we're unaware. And the second one is the cause for that is grasping. And this gets right at that because so much of thinking is about wanting and grasping and not wanting and wishing it wasn't and all of that. And then we suffer. And so to be able to be mindful of it right in the middle of it, that's where we can, magic almost, we can find some freedom there. So the other person I wanted to read from was Padmasambhava. So this is getting way off in the Tibetan part of my practice. Padmasambhava is a great, great figure in Buddhism. He brought Buddhism from India to Tibet in the 8th century. And from a point of view of the Nyingma school, regarded as a second Buddha. Very extraordinary. And there's all these teachings that he gave. And now I'm going down a slight sidestep. But in that tradition, they're called termas. And he left all these teachings and literally left them in rocks. And people found them, had visions, and was in a rock physically. And then some of them are mind termas. And people see something he said. They're pretty incredible. I mean, you might think, oh, this is just poppycock, except they're so incredible that maybe not. And one of my favorites, because one might say, I'm an old man, is called Pointing the Staff at the Old Man. And the backstory is this, a gentleman who's 61, but he considered himself an old man, who was taking care, he's sort of a supporter or a attendant for Padmasambhava for a year in Tibet. And then he was leaving and the man says, well, please give me a teaching that I can awaken in this lifetime because I'm an old man and I'm going to die soon. And you haven't really given me a teaching yet. And so he says, it's incredible. You can look it up online. It's really amazing. Pointing the staff at the old man. But about thoughts, what he says about thinking, it's just wonderful. And it's from a different dharmic point of view, from Nyingma school and more in the nature of mind teachings. But it completely resonates. That's what I love about it. It resonates and sort of interfaces with what Utejaniya said. So it's a little open your hearts and see if you can take it in. He says, within whatever moves in your mind, whatever you think has no essence but is empty. Thought occurrences are naturally freed. When remembering your mind essence, you can take thoughts as the path and the practice is easy. Isn't that cool? I mean, I don't think I'll read it again because I love it so much. He says, within whatever moves in your mind, whatever you think has no essence but is empty. Thought occurrences are naturally freed. When remembering your mind essence, you can take thoughts as the path and the practice is easy. So he's saying exactly the same thing. You know, whatever moves in your mind, it's empty. There's no self there. It's just happening. And you see that. Once you see that, then it can just happen. He's recognizing the thinking happening. He's not saying you have to stop your thoughts to be awakened. He said, no, you have to see it the right way. See it the way it is. And it says thought occurrences are naturally freed. Isn't that a great way to look at it? Just when you're aware, they're naturally freed. It might still be there, but they're not sticky anymore. That's the freed part. And then, you know, proliferate them. You know, what we do is like, you know, we think of like we're sitting and then we think of Hawaii, and then we think of surfing in Hawaii. Then we think of having fun surfing in Hawaii. Then remember this person that we surfed with. Then we remember the disappointment, and it goes on and on and on like that. But if just to be aware and realize there's no essence, they're just freed right there. We don't have to do all that stuff. And the practice is easy. So that's really, you know, the whole sense of not self. I understand that's challenging for people because it's so subtle. just like emptiness is challenging because it's so subtle. But this is an area where we can really see it at work. You know, you just sort of take that, whatever your understanding of that is, and see that that emerges from inside and use it in that arena of thinking. And it's just, that is a tool that helps us see through our sense of sticky self right there in that activity of thinking that seems like a problem. Whatever moves in your mind, whatever you think, has no essence but is empty. Sometimes it can be a useful metaphor. You know, like sometimes I'll say, if a thought arises, think of it like a bird flying by. You know, it's just this bird flying by. And if you don't feed the bird, it'll just keep on going and it'll be gone. If you feed it, it's going to stick around and want stuff and have this whole relationship with that. But if you just see it like let it go, and then once it's gone, it's gone. Or like a cloud in the sky, you know, you see the cloud and then it's gone. Then you can't, you know, how can you sort of remember what the cloud was? You can't, or say, oh, the cloud was, you can't even, you know, reproduce it. It's gone. So it's kind of like those things. And the two little, this is what I've touched on in the class before, but I think it's really useful. Two sort of tools that I'll talk about briefly and then get a chance to discuss. And one is, because this has to do with the kinds of things that we often think about, and it's helpful to be sort of prepared. So one of them is the whole question of past and future. Because much of what we think about, when you really think about what we think about, is past and future. We spend a lot of time mulling about the past and regurgitating, you know, you sit in the cushion and look, just sort of like make a list of what happens in your thinking part of your sitting. And a ton of it is thinking about the past, I bet. Does anyone have that experience ever? Yeah, okay. So a lot of it's thinking about the past, and a lot of it's thinking about the future. What am I going to be doing? What's scary? What's fun? What do I fear? What do I anticipate? All that stuff. I mean, if you take it, you know, I've never done the analysis, but it looks like sometimes like out of all the stuff, the mental activity, like 98% of it is past and future. You don't spend any time thinking about now because you're just here. What's to think about? So you're thinking about past and future there. But the funny thing is, when we're doing that, it's almost like that business where, you know, we think there is an I who's thinking. This other trick we play in ourselves is, when we're thinking about the past, we sort of think we're in the past. They're in the past thinking about, we're exploring, we're remembering, we're recreating, we're telling ourselves, we're having the colors and the smells and all that stuff. Or the future too. It's very tactile and alive. But actually, there is no past and future. It's all there is this. And the whole thing is happening in this instant. We're just beguiled into thinking we are actually in past and future. So if you really start to see that, I mean, really bring that into your heart and your understanding and see how that is in practice, it becomes really, really clear that any thought of past arises is happening in this instant. And any thought of future that arises is happening in this instant. And it just pulls you right back into now. It's exactly, bam, right in the now. It's pretty powerful. It's really powerful. Because it starts to sort of decode or untangle the part of us that gets tangled by all that yearning and wanting and fearing and obsessing and all that stuff that we do is so related to past and future. So it's really worth, you know, sort of, you know, I sometimes say, you know, like give ourselves a little Dharma talk before we sit, or if we're really off the rails, just stop. Okay. Now what am I doing here? And, you know, and remember, oh, this past I've been thinking about, it's right here. There is no past. It's just memories. There's no thing out there that's the past. It's just memories. And to really, you know, do that, kind of remind ourselves and then go back into our practice. Sometimes that can be worth doing. Same with future. And, you know, that's where mindfulness works, is in the present, into what's happening right now, what's arising and passing right now. It doesn't work in the past because there is no past. It does work in terms of our memories of the past. Be aware of those, be mindful of those. That works, but you can't be in the past because it doesn't exist. So you have to really be in the present. So it's just a very powerful tool to keep pulling us into now and to change our relationship with thinking. Because when we start to cut through that, then it becomes more obvious, like this insight happens around that. And all these thoughts that were so attractive, when you really get it, that there is no past you're in, it starts to disconnect the attractiveness of it. Well, one of the keys for me sometimes is, I don't know how to describe this, but like there's some little moment that somehow I remember. And I really realized, oh my God, nobody, even people who were there, don't remember that moment that I remembered. I'm remembering something about my own personal experience of it and how someone looked at me or didn't look at me or how something felt or an emotional sense I had at that time is completely subjective. I'm not talking about the past. I'm talking about my experience then, which is what I'm having now, which is what I can be mindful of now. But there's no thing there that's sort of in some objective sense the past. Every other person in that room had a different experience completely. And if I said, oh, this is what happened, they go, what? I don't know. What are you talking about? You know, so it's really, it's kind of embarrassing almost how much we concretize and make it's kind of objective what happened to us and think it's a thing. So it's very freedom and freeing. And then the other that I found really helpful is something called the Eight Worldly Dharmas. And that is a list of, it's in the suttas and all over the place, but it's a list of kind of, or called the Eight Worldly Concerns, like the four pairs that we in our worldly lives are concerned about. We're concerned with pleasure and pain, gain and loss, good reputation, bad reputation, and praise and blame. And you start to really look at it, you know what? That's kind of how it is. I mean, that really covers it. But what's really interesting to me, I was fascinated at first, was good reputation, bad reputation, and praise and blame. Why is that half of them? And I started to really realize that's what we're very social animals, and we do a ton of our world is all about, you know, are people liking what we're doing? Are they not liking? What do they think of us? Are we being blamed or not? And that's a huge amount of what we navigate. And that's a huge amount of what comes up in practice when you're being mindful, trying to be mindful. All that's part of a lot of the stories we tell ourselves is having been blamed or having been praised or how we are, you know, do people like us or not, or what's going on? How are we in the context? So being able to see through that and just, you know, it's a real useful tool to bring into when thinking seems compulsive. I go, oh yeah. I see what's going on. That's a good reputation thing happening again. And just to kind of recognize it. So I offer those two little things as kind of tools that you can kind of have in your toolbox, your Dharma toolbox, and pull out once in a while. Because part of the whole deal of being mindful of thinking is to be able to not be obsessed by it or drawn into it or sucked into it. And it's the hardest thing. When you really look at it, you know, your body, I mean, it might be distracting if your knee hurts, but you're not going to get sucked into it like that. And you're not going to identify with it. We all sort of know our knee is not me. You know, that's pretty easy. It's just a knee. But the thinking thing is, that's not so easy. And emotions are also, you know, that's hard too. So that's pretty much what I wanted to share.